Our heritage. Let us go once more down memory lane, but this time cover that bit extra ground. We will turn our steps towards the town of Bury itself, an important place in the years we are travelling in. What will interest us now are the various hospitals that still supply the people with their medical needs. Our first visit will be up the winding road to Fairfield, very large and impressive in these inland days. But it wasn't always so. We will visualise in our mind's eye the building of yesteryear, when it was known as the Bury Union Workhouse. We will see a very different picture than what it is today. In the middle of the 19th century, the land on which the hospital now stands was acquired, and it was opened as a workhouse in 1857. The actual opening was not an occasion for much pomp and excitement, and the Reverend Fletcher of St. Thomas's Church in Ratcliffe performed the act of opening. In the harsh industrial climate of 19th century England, this workhouse was never short of customers. In the space of 50 years, the number of inmates grew from 248 to 737. Bit by bit over the years, many extensions were added, and in 1862, room was needed for the poor infants that were born there. Again in 1868, separate accommodation was found for the insane. Space had to be found for infectious cases in 1876, and still the number of inmates grew. At one time, there was 800 of them cramped up together. The workhouse cemetery, first used in July 1858, was used extensively. By the turn of the century, in September 1905, a new hospital, accommodating 126 patients and staff, was opened by Councillor David Healy, Chairman of the Guardian Hospital Committee. In 1911, another male ward was opened by Mr. Robert Smith, Chairman of the House Committee. And so the years went by. During the 1914-18 war, a military hospital was established inside these dark grey walls, and casualties were admitted from the battlefields of France. As children growing up in the 1920s, we regarded this hospital as one of mystery. We were strong and healthy, and so had no need to venture through the gates. To our minds, it reminded us very much of a mill, with the black smoke pouring out of the brick chimney. During the 1930s, when unemployment was rife, gangs of men were sent up to the workhouse to do task work. Their dole money, which only lasted 26 weeks, was stopped. They got their dinners, but when the task work was done, off they had to go and look for jobs elsewhere. In 1939-40, the hospital became a decontamination centre and housed a radium unit from the Christie Hospital, Manchester. Alas and alack, Fairfield did suffer during the Second World War. In 1940, a bomb was dropped in the grounds near the lower hospital. By a stroke of luck, patients and nurses escaped injury. Indeed, over the years, this hospital has greatly improved from its days as a workhouse. The chimney was 130 feet high and was demolished in 1986. We will leave this hospital now with its memories, good and bad, and travel towards another one, very important in its own right, Bury Infirmary. This one stands just off a busy main road, and like the previous one, has had its ups and downs. To see it today, one can hardly believe what it once looked like and stood for. The picture I have in mind was taken in 1915 and shows the imposing entrance to this hospital. One can see very plainly the big chimney from which poured the smoke. This chimney still stands today, but over the years its height has been greatly reduced. When it was in its heyday, it could be seen many miles away. The grounds in front of the hospital were a good deal smaller in those days. Maybe the fact that the motor car was in its infancy, having no need for a car park. which now exists. The lodge at the end of the drive was in use then, and visitors, etc., had to call there and state their business. One interesting fact about this hospital is that the different wards have each got an individual name, referring to notable people of the town and the various events that have taken place over the years. One item worthy of note is the fact that the chimney now stands at 98 feet. Previously, its height was 101 feet. It is built of London brick and still remains part and parcel of this hospital. On March 25, 1882, the infirmary was opened by Lord Derby. On July 5, 1948, the National Health Service commenced. From then onwards, expansion was needed, and in 1956, the pathology department was opened, to be followed in due course by a new outpatients department and accident departments. All the different treatment rooms and departments followed rapidly, and so we now have the hospital of today. Bury Infirmary, as we knew it, played a big part in the running of Fairfield Hospital, inasmuch as it provided a maternity service for the cost of £3, so that the local people used to save their hard-earned pennies to try and raise this sum, rather than have the fatal entry in the address column of the child's birth certificate, it having been born in the workhouse. Her Royal Highness Princess Anne visited this hospital on May 13, 1982, and saw for herself the good work that is carried out. This year, 1988, sees the 50th year of the running of the WRVS from 1938. Our next port of call will be to the Florence Nightingale Hospital, situated off the busy Bury to Bolton Road. Very important in its own right. It was built in the first place to house those unfortunate enough to have scarlet fever, an illness that was widespread during those early years. The art of healing hadn't reached its peak in those days. The foundation stone was laid on July the 13th, 1901, by Alderman John Parks. It changed from a fever hospital just after the Second World War, most likely 1948, when it became part of the National Health Service. It is reached by crossing over a bridge, underneath which the steam trains used to run from Bury to Bolton and beyond. In recent years, a lot of changes have taken place, including new wards. There are still quite a lot of trees in this area, which tend to enhance it in the summertime. Now we move on towards Ratley, and come across our next hospital, known as Bealey's. This is just beyond the Bury border. It was once a private house standing in its own grounds, but in our time and memory, it was known as a maternity hospital, and remained as such until February the 8th, 1980, when it was changed over to geriatrics. Fairfield Hospital now takes care of the maternity side. A lot of changes have taken place here, both outside and in. The old people are well looked after, and the whole atmosphere is homely and friendly. The gardens are well laid out, and make a good show when the roses are in bloom. And so we leave this town of Bury and make our way to Somerset. A special school and hospital in the village was opened on August the 19th, 1913. The children were sent here to recover from consumption. They came from the crowded streets of the city of Salford. For a long time, only girls were admitted, and now and again, us children would catch a glimpse of them. They were all dressed alike, in navy blue gym slips and red jerseys. In December 1954, for the very first time, all the children were sent home for the Christmas holiday. In January 1955, a television set was installed on the premises. On November the 16th, 1955, the first boys were admitted. Quite a long gap between, namely 42 years. As far as possible, the date of this school and hospital goes back to 1836. We again set off on our travels, this time to Ramsbottom. In this town stands the Cottage Hospital. This building was erected in 1898, during Queen Victoria's reign. The operating table and other furnishings were the gifts of Ramsbottom Medical Services Fund in October 1937. Extensions were added and opened on October 23rd, 1967. On the walls inside the buildings are various pictures of the notable people of the time. One picture that catches the eye is a drawing of the hospital in modern times. The artist drew this in 1984. Alongside this picture is a small window with the figure of Queen Victoria in all her glory. The colours here are really beautiful. Round the back of the hospital stands the tall trees, which look very nice in full leaf. In the 1920s, this hospital dealt with accidents and remained as such for many years. If one followed the road that passed it, one would find oneself in Nuttall Village, very independent in its day, the little stone cottages and green fields being very prominent. At the time of writing, the outlook is vastly different. Even the ground very near to the hospital has been encroached upon. In these times, the old and infirm are cared for within these walls, and the nurses and staff do their very best to tender to the wants of these patients. Shall we leave this part of Ramsbottom now and travel towards Holcombe? Halfway up the slopes, there once stood another hospital, known as Aitken Sanatorium. At one time of the day, this had been a private house, standing in its own grounds. I remember it very well in the 1920s, and I used to feel very sorry indeed for the patients that had to stay there. In those days, consumption was rife, and the clean, pure air that came across those hills was considered to be very beneficial to the sufferers of this complaint. Underneath the tall trees that were very plentiful in these grounds were erected small wooden chalets, and some of the patients used to lie in these in order to breathe the fresh air. On Good Friday, when scores of people used to trudge to the top of Holcombe Hill, this hospital could be seen quite clearly from a good distance away. But alas and alack, it was closed as a hospital in 1971. The building still stands, a ghost of its former self. To finish this story of medicine, we will now make our way to the other side of the valley. Just over the border from Bury into Ramsbottom stands another hospital. This one too has altered very much over the years. It was known in its heyday as a home for incurables. The gentleman who left this property and the grounds was a Mr. John Robinson Kay. He was born in Burnley and came to Somerset on July the 20th, 1805, with his father. He was one of the village's benefactors, and in his will, this large house was left to be used as a home for those unable to walk or care for themselves. In this present day and age, it is used for the old and infirm. During the 1920s, as children, the scholars from the two Methodist churches in the village marched up to this hospital on Whit Friday to sing to the patients. Each child would receive an orange, and it was nice to listen to the band. We would see the cows and the sheep as they grazed in the green grass. At the end of the long drive stood a house known as the Lodge. The keeper and caretaker lived here, and we were taught to keep well away. The photograph I have in mind of this home was taken in 1909, but to look at the place today, one is of the opinion that the building itself has altered very little. The cattle no longer graze there, and the lodge is no longer in use. The busy hum of traffic is heard nowadays as we come out of the driveway onto the main road. Who knows what lies ahead for all these hospitals? Man himself is never satisfied. Since he began his existence on this earth, he has discovered more and more of the art of healing. Diseases that once had the monopoly over him are things of the past, and yet he still has a long way to go and a lot of studying and learning to do within the four walls of these hospitals. One ailment that he still has to conquer is the common cold. Rich and poor, all and sundry, suffer from it at some time in their life. He certainly tries his best to stave off this menace, but still it beats him. Maybe in the coming years he will find a cure. In the meantime, we will stay loyal and grateful to nurses, doctors and staff of the present day, and wish them every success in their different ventures. Footnote. One item that is worthy of note is the following. A firm of builders and contractors, J. Tinline, worked on the building of Jericho Workhouse in 1857. And again, the same firm built a new wing at the infirmary in 1893. In modern times, the Bury Lions take a great interest in the patients by providing them with music and records of their own choice. The League of Friends do their share in caring too. All right. Mm-hmm. Time will tell. We will deal with some of the events that happened and the value of money and what it could buy during the years 1881 to 1981. In 1881, Queen Victoria was on the throne of England, and there was a clear distinction between rich and poor. Inventions that caught the public's imagination was the electric tram car and the use of gas fires in the home. The wages a farm labourer drew was 18 shillings a week, and income tax was 7 pence in the pound. A house with two bedrooms sold at £300 and was let at 7 shillings per week. One pair of men's boots, 3 shillings, and oranges were 10 for 2 pence. England was at war with the Boers in South Africa, and at the Battle of Marjupa Hill she lost 250 soldiers. 1891. The railway fare from London to Manchester was 15 shillings. A man's shirt cost 1 3. Leather gloves were 2 11 a pair. Herrings were 6 for 2 pence. One Axminster carpet sold at 5 shillings per yard, and spectacles were 1 11 a pair. Dr. W. G. Grace was a famous cricketer during this time. 1901. Just before Queen Victoria died, she saw the coming in of the following: the cinema, gramophone records, the Manchester Ship Canal, X-rays, and the safety razor, the first submarine, the diesel engine, and radium. The school leaving age had risen to 14 years. A miner was earning £1.15 weekly, and a railway clerk £1.10. Champagne was 8 shillings a bottle, and coal was 1 6 a hundredweight. An alarm clock cost 4 6 pence. One silver pocket watch sold at 25 shillings. Queen Alexandra celebrated her 57th birthday on December the 1st. She came to this country in 1863 to become the wife of King Edward the 7th when he was Prince of Wales. 1911. A lot of events took place this particular year, one fact being that the aeroplane had arrived. Also the Rolls Royce. There was a terrible earthquake in San Francisco. People were dancing the tango, and there was rugby football at Twickenham, and King George V was on the throne. A two-bedroomed house sold for £350 and rented for 8 shillings a week. Plain chocolate was 7 pence half a pound. State pensions at 70 years, 5 shillings a week. Labourer's wage was £1.6 a week, and a bank clerk £1.10. Cigarettes were 20 for 7 pence. Butter was 1 4 pence a pound. 1921. People were dancing the Charleston and mad about jazz. The wireless had arrived, also the automatic telephone. The farmers began to use the tractors on their farms, and the British Legion came into being. Jack Dempsey was the world's heavyweight champion. This year, a skilled labourer earned £5 a week, and unskilled £4. Income tax was just over 5 shillings in the pound. One bicycle cost £6. A Morris Cowley motor car, a two-seater, was £175, and the Humber, 12 horsepower, was £300. A vacuum cleaner, £10, and a carpet sweeper, 15 shillings. Beer was sixpence a pint, and pipe tobacco, a shilling an ounce. Half dozen steel knives in a box, £1. Among the different advertisements this year was the following. One parrot, complete with its cage, £2. 1931, unemployment was rising towards the 3 million mark, and the dole dropped from 18 shillings a week to 15 shillings. The talking pictures were here, and electric razors, zip fasteners, penicillin, and the Road Traffic Act. Harold Lloyd was making people laugh, and Greta Garbo was a famous film star. A three-bedroomed house in London cost £750, and in the provinces, £650. 13 days cruise in the Mediterranean was £23. A three-course lunch in a restaurant was 2 shillings. A fish tea was 1 and 6 pence. Pork sausages, 1 and 2 pence a pound. A policeman's wage was £4.12, and a parlour maid earned £48 a year. 1941. England was at war with Germany, and our way of life was badly affected. Food was rationed. Streets, buildings and people's homes were blacked out. Clothing coupons were issued to rich and poor alike. In the cinemas, the film The Great Dictator was shown, starring Charlie Chaplin, taking the part of Hitler. On the wireless, the show Itmar was making people laugh, and among countless other things, we had to learn to make do and mend. Income tax was 10 shillings in the pound, and a radio licence was £1. Old age pensions were 10 shillings a week. Boot and shoelaces were 3 pence a pair. Hair cream was 6 pence a jar, and envelopes were 3 shillings for 20. 1951. Battersea Fun Fair was opened, also the Festival Hall. The whole country suffered from severe flooding. The school leaving age was raised to 15 years, and the National Insurance Act came into force. This particular year, we had the Festival of Britain, holiday camps, and coal and gas was nationalised. Ballpoint pens were introduced, and beer strength was increased by 10%. Potatoes were 3 pence a pound, and cheese was 9 pence a pound. A man's overcoat was £12, and a holiday in Blackpool, full board, was 15 shillings a day. One could go to Austria for 17 days, £21. Spain, 8 days, £20. And Paris, 5 days, for £11. A gas or electric cooker was £23, and a sirloin of beef was 3 and 6 a pound. A man's haircut was 5 shillings. A lady's dress made of rayon was 25 shillings. And a colour camera was £1.17 and 6 pence. Colour films were 2 and 11 for 16 exposures. 61. The 60s were just getting into the swing, and the group known as the Beatles came into being. We had rock and roll, and Elvis Presley and Lonnie Donegan. This year, Cliff Richard was 21 years old. There was a battle going on between Russia and America in their race for the moon. Betting shops had arrived, also the M1 motorway. Supermarkets were here, and self-service petrol pumps. The wages a farm labourer earned in this year was £11.10 a week, and a cleaner got 4 shillings an hour. A greenhouse cost £16, and a single electric blanket was £2.15. A man's leather jacket was £10, and 2 pairs of cotton drill jeans were just over £1. A TV set could be rented at 9 shillings a week. 71. Quite a lot of important events took place this year, including the fact that the Americans had been to the moon and back. Countless people watched this great feat on the television. Human heart transplants had taken place, and we had North Sea gas and decimal coinage had arrived on the scene. The voting age was lowered to 18 years, and a 70-mile-per-hour speed limit was made law. Milk was sixpence a pint, and sugar 1 and 4 pence a pound, butter being 5 shillings a pound. Cigarettes were 6 and 2 pence for 20, and cheddar cheese was 5 shillings a pound. A miner drew £19 a week, and a textile worker £13. Petrol was 6 and 8 pence per gallon. Postage stamps, first class 7 pence, second class 4 pence. 81. This was a very mixed up year, entailing events good and bad. Unemployment was rife, and we had to contend with street rioting. Northern Ireland was giving major worries, but most of the time life wasn't too bad. Freezers became commonplace, and video recorders. Concord has proved to be more than a 9 days wonder. The transplant of our various organs are frequent, but I'm afraid that man still has to find a cure for the common cold. A 3-bedroom house cost £25,000, and a secretary was paid £90 a week. A man's suit, £70, and a family saloon car cost £4,000. Apples were 3 shillings a pound, and one could rent a video for £3 weekly. Beer was 11 shillings a pint, and the